curious what that is, the diversity requirement at the University of Washington?
Yeah, so it was a requirement to include courses that would be available in the UW curriculum for students to choose. I don't want to mess it up because when I was there, it was still being pushed on, but it was pushing for at least two classes between by the time a student graduates that were related to diversity. And so these classes could range from taking a course on African-American history to Queer 101 studies or just a range of issues that were included as a diversity that would be counted in the diversity requirement. And so I think this applied to students that were going to be freshmen in the class of 2015 and after.
And are there further steps that you feel are necessary to address this SAE incident and the racism on the campus of University of Washington?
Certainly there are, but I think so far UW reaching out and trying to get evidence of this particular incident is a step, but once again, I can't speak to exactly what's happening between the UW administrators and BSU and SAE.
Well, and we will continue to check in on this incident and this issue. Again, I'm speaking with Karen Monterajo. She's an alumnus of the Black Student Union at the University of Washington. Karen, thank you so much for joining us on KBOO.
Thank you so much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Occupy the Farm, playing at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30 p.m.
Our main concern is water right now.
The university actually shut off our water.
What we're going to be doing is handing buckets over the fence.
Occupy the Farm tells the inspiring story of 200 farmers who occupy the last piece of farmland in California's urban East Bay, planting 15,000 seedlings to feed the community and disrupt plans to build a shopping mall. That's Occupy the Farm, Thursday, April 2nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess, and she, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
Good evening, dear listeners. Welcome to Out Loud here on KBOO. Out here, open my hands to you, my boss. We'll be back at the show. Let's start the show.
And that's all for today from the IMEMC News.
Welcome to Out Loud, dear listeners. That was Shea St. John with their classic Fingers Blown Off by Fireworks. I thought that'd be a good introduction to our first segment tonight here on Out Loud. We're going to be talking about queer horror. And if you know anything about Shea St. John, horror is a great adjective to use. Welcome, dear guests. We have Anthony Hudson.
Hi.
Hi there. And Sean Brown.
Hi, Out Louders.
Good. Thank you so much for being here. We're gonna have you each talk a little bit about yourselves. Anthony, you are hosting a fabulous event tomorrow night, Queer Horror. It's a collection of shorts at the Hollywood Theater.
Yes.
And you are a couple of things. PNCA's media resident, is that right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the first media residence through PNCA and the Hollywood Theater's new program they're doing.
And you are also creator of Carla Rossi, who I believe is actually hosting tomorrow night at Queer Horror.
Unfortunately, yes, that's true. I'm very sorry. I'll have waivers provided to all of the audience members as they enter.
So. That cuts you a break, not them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So explain to us who Carla Rossi is.
Carla Rossi is Portland's premier drag clown. She's the ghost of white privilege, and that's funny because it will never die. So that's my little joke that I do every time I introduce Carla or she introduces herself. She's a local drag clown. She's my way of dealing with my mixed race ancestry and my place as a confused queer young person in the world. And she also is kind of my occupation, too. I'm lucky enough to get to do a lot of shows as her and host cabaret events around town and one-woman shows now, too. So this is my latest foray with Carla's through this residency. I've been doing three events. This is my final event at the beautiful historic Hollywood Theater. And I wanted to combine my two favorite things, which are being Carla and horror movies. I love horror movies so much.
And Sean, welcome. You are a local filmmaker.
Thank you. Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what your work looks like.
It's a horror. what some people have said. maybe not intentionally. Well, I have begun a series of films that I want to that I've wanted to make for $500 or less. It's a project that has taken three very distinct paths. My first film, Cocoon. It was an homage to 60s exploitation filmmaker Andy Milligan, and written and produced in the style of one of my favorite Andy Milligan pictures, Seeds of Sin, which is just a masterpiece of crap. And Cocoon is a modern spin on that with a particular queer bent to it. The central characters are a lesbian couple, and murder and mayhem follow in the dark tunnels of underground Portland. And then my second film was took that camp and silliness of Cocoon 100 steps farther and is a parody of Lucha Libre. Got it. I've just been given a note saying not to go farther than
go
the
to
C
the
word.
Principal's office.
I do have a potty mouth, and it comes out in film, as a matter of fact. They're all NC-17. No, that's not true. They're not rated at all. In any case, Boo Demon is my second film and was a parody of Lucha Libre, which I grew up watching and I love, but I am ashamed to say I speak very little Spanish, and so while the picture is entirely in Spanish, the subtitles do not relate at all to what is being said, and my actors, and the soundtrack is all in Spanish, but my actors were just mostly counting during the production. That said, we went over really well in Spain, and I have some folks from Mexico City who were very into it as well, oddly enough. But my new picture is entirely different, and it is a much more serious picture with a script that is neither a parody nor an homage. It is all an original piece that's a little bit more reflective, I think, of who I am and what I'm about right now.
Now that current film you're working on, the third part of this kind of trilogy.
Yes. Well, they're all about Portland. All three of these pictures. So it's a Portland trilogy.
Okay. Mm. I know that it stars Nick Matos.
It does. It stars Nick Matos and it stars David Basila from Los Angeles. And some others.
And you, Anthony, had Nick as part of a performance last month?
I did, yeah, almost 1 month ago, exactly.
Do you want to give us a little summary of that event? We talked about it on the air with you, and I'd like to hear.
It was called The Hiding Place, and it was a queer storytelling cabaret that was held in the Anne Frank exhibit at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. And so a bunch of storytellers, actually not even professional storytellers, but just real people in the community came out and told stories about coming out and hiding and survival, kind of in tribute to Anne Frank. And then Carla was there also hosting.
How do you think it came off?
I'm so proud of that night and I love it. And I was terrified when I noticed people leaving towards the end of the show, but it turned out they were the older patrons that had to go to bed. Not that age has anything to do with it, but they did have to go to bed. It was on a school night. And I heard some really great feedback afterwards. I mean, when you talk about horror, that show, doing a show in the Anne Frank exhibit about Anne Frank was probably one of the scariest things I've ever done, putting myself out there and not being a person with any Jewish heritage. But coming into it as this clown who proclaims to be the most famous white woman in Portland and talking about a sensitive subject, there was really great feedback, and I think the audience left really happy.
Wonderful. So let's talk about queer horror.
Yeah.
First, specifically, you're hosting, as Carla, this exhibit of shorts tomorrow at Hollywood Theater.
Yes, it's a multimedia special commercial. It's a special commercial. I'm so excited because what I wanted to do when I applied for this residency, and I had to come up with a project, you know, in my proposal. And so I was like, well, I love horror so much. My boyfriend, actually now fiance, yay, heteronormativity. Thank you. He's a painter, and he did this painting with these voluptuous lips, and in like kind of a bleeding text font, it says queer horror. And so he had just done that, and I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about our shared love of horror and how it kind of brought us together. And I was thinking, I really want to take an event and just call it queer horror and invite performers to come out and do their interpretation of how we relate to horror as queer people and what it means to us. And then I want to take short films and turn it into a short film showcase at the same time. So this show was selected through an open call. I did a giant open call across the internet. I reached out to a couple other people, like the Soska sisters. They directed American Mary and See No Evil 2. They do a lot of, they're these amazing, like, kind of Rebel Without a Crew twins from Canada that do just awesome independent films, and now they're making movies for the wrestling people, WWE. But they're fantastic, and I took some stuff from them, from Peaches Christ down in San Francisco that hosts Midnight Mass, big new upcoming filmmaker named James Sizemore, and lots of local people, lots of local queer filmmakers and people from elsewhere.
Wonderful. So that's tomorrow night, Hollywood Theater.
Yeah, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and it's $8 to get in. Sure. I am suggesting like 18 and up just as far as some content, but really everybody's welcome.
All right. You can find out the information about Queer Horror on, among other places, our Facebook. Look for us Out Loud, KBOO Out Loud on Facebook, and follow all the news that we can find in Portland that's interesting and what we're going to do on the show coming up. So let's talk about queer horror more generally. Now, I think, how do I want to say that queer horror is something, it could be said, that horror relied on a sort of a deep, you know, horror movies, horror films, the genre relied on a deep homophobia to create this sense of, you know, this atmosphere of foreboding for your average.
There's a great German short called Homophobia, which is a horror film.
Ooh.
It's really good, yeah. Oh.
And I guess my sense is that, you know, there's something about horror that queers are now, queer folks, queer artists, and queer performers are now embracing.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about that.
I love the topic of queer horror because it's so encompassing. Mm-hmm. Just for some people, just you can stop at queer and that's horror enough.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
It's just so subversive. Horror can be, but queer, of course, is also subversive. And one of my favorite things, which is not generally thought of as a horror picture, but if you see it the way I see it, there are many people out there who would think of it then as horror and never let their children watch it again, and that's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the 60s stop motion, yeah. Because it is so subversive and all about breaking norms.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love I love the topic of queer horror because horror, the monster is the killer, you know, he's always other, he's always, or she is the outsider, and up until recently, until you got engaged, actually, we were all sort of the outsider.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how that was the impetus for jumping into the Queer Horror Festival, was like kind of the sort of artist statement that I put out there on the call for entries was, why do we relate so strongly to horror, and how do we identify with the monster, or how do we identify with the monster? How do we relate to the monster? What is it about horror movies and this whole connection to otherness that we really relate to? I think for me growing up, I really responded to horror movies really early on as a kid because they were almost like fairy tales for me. And if you think of some of the old Grimm's fairy tales really are horror stories, or at least the best ones. Yeah. And there's some morality plays in those tales and then in horror movies too, but I think there's this realm of like the dead can come back to life, there's unstoppable supernatural monsters and killers, and it's all a real wonderful imaginative fantasy where anything could happen. But it is interesting that you talk about the monster or the killer and kind of the inbred homophobia that's in the genre or was in the genre. And it's interesting thinking about that because, like, for example, in movies like Sleepaway Camp or Psycho or Silence of the Lambs, spoiler alert, you know, most of the killers in those have kind of a trans identity or identified as sort of trans or these other characters.
Which they will be punished for.
And they will be punished for, yeah, yes. Exactly. And it's really fascinating. But if you look back, like, some of the first horror movies, like F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu. He was a gay filmmaker, and that was about him dealing with his homosexuality. James Whale did Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein.
Bride of Frankenstein. Oh, it's so good.
And that really goes into that area of the fantastic with the, oh God, what's the doctor's name? The older doctor that comes in, and he has these little people that live in jars.
Oh, that's a great movie.
It's so bizarre. Yeah. And there's this little sequence where these little people that live in jars are having this like social drama, and there's a little tiny pope and a little wife
and a little dancer.
Yeah.
A little dancer.
And it's amazing. I think those are the seeds of, I think, that kind of camp sensibility that also went on to develop into campiness, but also to develop this sort of...
Well, have you ever seen Rope? Hitchcock's Rope?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the two guys. I love Rope because it's these two guys who are, you know, clearly a couple, and they live a fabulous life, seemingly in the village or somewhere in Manhattan, and they have a dinner party with all of these lovely straight people who come over, Jimmy Stewart, one of them, who must know that they're gay. But of course the gay people are evil. And they have plotted and succeeded in killing their friend. And then, not only that, put the friend in a trunk and then serve dinner on top of the trunk. So, I mean, it's
like
just,
you do.
Like you do. Exactly.
What about Tom Ripley?
Oh, gosh, of course.
Patricia Highsmith.
Of course, Patricia Highsmith and Ripley, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other 30 books she wrote that were also, you know, horror mm-hmm. stories. Ripley was just the most famous. So let's go back a little bit and talk about queer.
Yeah.
What's the notion of queer? Let's stop there and look at that.
Well, currently, you know, what I've been seeing in a lot of young filmmakers' products is a lot of eroticism that is part of their horror stories. It seems like you can't watch a queer horror film without there being several shower scenes. And,
oh yeah,
and you know, not everybody is Brian De Palma. I love me some Brian De Palma, and he does that. But I think sometimes that eroticism kind of while it's always beautiful to look at, sometimes it gets in the way of the story a little bit. And I personally, as a filmmaker, have removed that element almost entirely from my pictures. I don't know, maybe I'm a little old school. I like my gay porn in 5-minute clips on Pornhub. <you know?
laughs> A really good example of that is Leeches, where it's a it's a male swim team mm-hmm. who spend most of the movie in swim trunks, and there's both a serial killer stalking the team and giant radioactive leeches in the pools killing them as well, and then there's somebody else who's murdering people, like someone connected to the team.
Leeches aren't enough.
Is this Italian?
No,
it sounds like it should be Italian.
No, it's about 5 years ago.
Okay. That sounds remarkable. It is really funny when they, I think, Jeepers Creepers 2, it was also about like a, there was a touring football team or something, and lots of scenes of like all these shirtless dudes hanging out on their school bus, tanning themselves like you do.
Which happened a lot when I was in school.
Yeah.
A lot.
Oh, that's every day of my school.
Mm-hmm. So what is empowering, to use a word that comes to mind? Maybe not my favorite word, but what's empowering about creating queer horror?
Well, for one thing, not punishing queers for being queer. there's this normalization of gayness, of gay identity that has been happening for 30 years, since Stonewall, I guess, but has really picked up a lot of steam lately. And I think that it's really fun. In my pictures, I never focus on, it's never mentioned that this is the gay character, or this is a gay couple, or they exist in the world as we do exist in the world. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but most of my day, every day, just I don't typically come out and mention, well, oh, yeah, I'm gay. It comes up with my coworkers, or it comes up, you know, from time to time. It's just not quite what it was in the 80s when you know, when I was younger, that where it seemed being gay was something that you wore out front. And of course there were a lot of different reasons for that, but now there's we're just kind of a part of everyday life, and I really enjoy having my characters be part of everyday life. And in fact, in Radio Silence, my new picture, the couple in it is a same-sex couple, and they are experiencing a domestic violence crisis, which is not necessarily something that you often see in, I've never seen it in depicted on, mm-hmm. on film, as a matter of fact. So,
so it's queer folks as subject rather than object.
That's exactly right, yes.
I'm fascinated, as I've been programming this Queer Horror Film Festival, I'm fascinated by how we respond to horror. And something that I've seen, like, across the board, like, maybe 80% of the submissions and the final, you know, entries that are in here are so comedic. I mean, I wanted a little more jump scares just so I could get, like, the willies, you know, but...
It's hard to get away from camp, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I'm so happy with what we have, and I think the audience is absolutely just going to die laughing and hopefully in fright during some of the more spooky segments, but... hence the waivers. But I'm so excited and interested in how there's so much comedy in these shorts. And I really think that kind of, and I understand this culturally, being somebody who's half Native and having, you know, half of my family lives on the reservation. And when I go home or I see my family or my brothers from the reservation, it's there's a constant reliance and use of comedy. And Natives, I've always said, laugh harder than anybody else. And it's funny going into this now and seeing that kind of echoed. And I think that, you know, we live around horror so much growing up queer or gay or however we identify, that sometimes laughter is the best way to depower these systems that have put us down, or to deal with it or to own it, you know. And it's really wonderful to see how much comedy goes into this and how people really have to deal with the more horrific things in life.
Uh-huh.
That was my Miss America answer. But yeah, it's...
Some people don't have maps and so forth. And...
But it's really, it's so much fun. And I think it's... It is exciting too, you know, there's a certain level of empowering or self-empowering to actually get to, I mean, in a lot of movies where there's, like, Silence of the Lambs, for example, you know, the killer is, there's a straight man writing the story and making the killer a trans-identified person. But to take a movie where a drag queen has a chainsaw and the drag queen is making that movie, there is a level of fantasy and empowerment that comes with that too, where it's, you can say, like, oh, well, I've been called a monster my whole life, so now you get to see me as the monster I want to be, which I think is really fun.
That is really fun. And the character of Buffalo Bill sort of mutating from the Ed Gein, which is, or Gein, whatever, however it's pronounced, who that he's patterned on. And Ed was not trans at all. He was just a sick person.
Yeah.
And then to take that and turn that into something that is as kind of offensive, really, as Buffalo Bill really is, is a little bit of a slap in the face. And I'm not sure that a gay writer would have done that.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because in that series later on, there's also a lesbian character who basically, it seems like she becomes a lesbian because a history of sexual abuse. And it's like, I don't know that that's exactly how things work, Thomas Harris. But then it's funny, actually, if you look at Ed Gein and look at, who is the next? Norman Bates. And then Leatherface.
Right, right.
And then Buffalo Bill.
And now Leatherface is a great character. I love Leatherface.
Especially when you get to, the movie is awful, but when you get to like the 12th sequel or remake, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The New Beginning,
right,
with Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey as babies.
Was that before her face left?
Yeah.
Good.
But if you, but she just talked to Leatherface and he helped her out. But Leatherface in that movie, it, that was awful, you guys. I can't believe I said that. Leatherface in that movie was in drag. Leatherface was a drag queen in that movie.
In the first movie, he is too.
Yeah, oh yeah, he did have a moment.
And he acts like the mom or something. Yeah. It's so funny.
And that movie is so far out that it's not as offensive, but...
No, I don't think it is.
Yeah, it's funny now seeing how things are changing too with newer horror movies. There's a lot more empowerment of women. The final girls are getting tougher and tougher. I don't know if you guys saw Your Next.
Yes.
So good. Best final girl in a movie ever. It's like watching Home Alone with Home Invasion, where the final girl is setting up traps. And there's movies like The Guest, where they really kind of queer the young male villain and kind of turn the male gaze on him instead of turning it on the targeted female. It's really, I think it's a great time for horror and for queer people.
I do too. And I've also seen a lot less homophobia among straight characters. For instance, yeah, if there is some male-male contact between characters, they often don't jump back and then rush for the Listerine. It just kind of happens.
You know? Yeah,
it's fun.
All right, thank you so much, Anthony and Sean, for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
Thank you. Yes.
Queer Horror is tomorrow. What time?
Tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Historic Hollywood Theater.
Wonderful. Check it out. All right, we'll be back with Morgan Fitzgibbon. We're going to talk about Bisexual Mental Health Month. We'll be back in just a couple of moments here on Out Loud.
Just sit here and daydream. So you're heading our way to on the hot sauce subway, yeah. Singing the blues on the subway train. Check it out, yo. Ain't it hard? That's a fact, but I can rise above when I have love.
Here comes the train.
Please don't turn and walk away. Stay. We can reach something the sock is shot. I lose myself in the book, I stick to my heaven
too.
Or we can read the voice, it's your choice.
I just wanna get to know you.
Blues on the subway train. Hey, so you're heading my way to London High.
Welcome back to Out Loud, dear listeners. Thanks for being here. That was Michelle Indegeocello. It is Bisexual Mental Health Month, or Bisexual Health Awareness Month as well, as designated by the Bisexual Resource Center, a national advocacy network. We have here to talk with us about it Morgan Fitzgibbon.
Hi.
Hi there. Please tell us what you do in our fair city.
Sure. Well, my background is in LGBT affirmative therapy. So I work with a broad spectrum of people from the queer community. I work with a lot of non-monogamous people. I definitely specialize in working with bisexual people. I have a bisexual therapy group that I run, and I am a member of the local bisexual community as well.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. So tell us how it is that Bisexual Mental Health Month came to be so necessary.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, the statistics on bisexual mental health are actually really disappointing. There's been a couple of reports recently on research on bisexual mental health. And bisexual people have some of the highest rates of depression and anxiety. That's both compared to heterosexual people and also compared to gay and lesbian individuals. We also see some of the highest rates of self-harm, suicidal thought, and actually completing suicide, high rates of substance abuse, higher rates of intimate partner violence, and much less social support, which really kind of underlies all of those issues.
Mm-hmm. And we heard last year from some researchers for the state who are beginning to who do health survey tracking year by year, and they're beginning to be able to do statistical analysis of folks who identify as gay or lesbian or bisexual. And one of the things that they reported was just what you said, that health outcomes, to use their technical language, for bisexual folks were worse than for folks who identify straight or folks who identify as gay or lesbian. And so this is not just a national concern, it's also a local one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do think we're lucky here in that we have a somewhat visible bisexual community, if you know where to look, which can be really hard to find. But yes, it's definitely an issue locally as well.
So tell us some about what kinds of organizing the bisexual community here in Portland or in the Portland area is engaged in.
Okay. Well, we could start with my group, which offers a place to kind of get support and community and do some identity development with other people that identify similarly. We also have a great discussion group at the Q Center, which happens, I think, the fourth Tuesday of the month. There's a social gathering at the Bi Bar at Crush, which is the second Tuesday of the month. Those are the big three local ones.
How about advocacy among service providers? Because clearly there's so much training that needs to be done. Let's talk about that. I mean, medical professionals, therapists, doctors, nurses, all of these folks need to be able to communicate with folks well, whatever their life situation is, whatever their needs are. And that takes real training about who people are, how to interact with them, how to give them care, being open isn't enough, but you need to have some tools to work with as well to be able to provide good care.
So are you asking what training's available for medical professionals?
What are folks doing to shift thinking among service providers, among say the county health network, state funding?
Well, statewide, I'm not sure. I definitely know that bisexual mental health as a topic is becoming much more of a discussion, which I think is excellent. Bisexual visibility, just in general, is people are much more aware of it, it seems. So I think that's very helpful, at least as a start. I think there's two sides to that issue, and the other side is that bisexual people are much less likely to be out to their medical providers. So that already starts off with an issue of, you know, being able to openly discuss those sorts of issues. As far as training goes, it's really limited right now. You know, I don't know of any bisexual, either medical or psychological training that's available. I wish I did. That would be really incredible. So it's reading research and meeting with other people that work with the same population.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what bisexuality is.
Oh, that's a big question.
It is a big question. And we have some time to sort of grapple with it.
Yeah.
Everybody has their own idea of what bisexuality is, whether they identify as bisexual or not. So, let's take a look at that.
Mm-hmm. I think the definition I prefer is being romantically or sexually attracted to people of a variety of gender identities, not just your own or not just whatever would be on the opposite end of that gender spectrum. Some people look at the term bisexual a little more narrow and see it as really either very kind of male-female centric, and that they are afraid that that's exclusive to the transgender community. And so many people use the term pansexual to be more inclusive. I also know that there are many people that just choose to use the term queer instead, because they feel like that is more inclusive and less divisive of the community as a whole.
When you say they choose to use the label queer, mm-hmm. do you mean for themselves?
Yes.
So that they aren't sort of shutting anyone out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have a caller. Hello, caller.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Is this Lynette?
Yes, this is. How are you doing?
I'm good. Welcome back. We have with us here on the telephone Lynette McFadden, who's another fabulous bisexual community activist and organizer. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. So you do a couple of things. One is a podcast.
Yes, I have the podcast, the Bicast, the podcast for the bisexual community. Mm-hmm. We have done over 80 different episodes covering a variety of topics, people, events, basically getting the information out to the community that they have one and they are not alone and there is information out there for them. I also just was elected to the board of Binet USA recently.
Oh, fabulous.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I believe, and I'm pulling this off of some stuff I was looking at the web today. Binet USA has, I believe, a list of therapists who specialize in bisexuality or are... is that right?
Yes, we're working on that list, and it is growing. It is not something that is actually taught when you become a therapist, and many of the therapists, like Morgan, have actually... develop their own programs, and the list is growing. And we do have some resources on how to find one also.
Yes. And is Binet USA engaged in advocacy around mental health training, mental health care for bisexuals?
Yes. And we provide a very good mental health training presentation. You can find it's actually all-inclusive of all of the bisexual issues that is on the Binet USA site. And the Bisexual Resource Center, this is their second year of running a Bisexual Health Awareness Month. This year it is focused on mental health. And if you follow the hashtag BiHealthMonth, mm-hmm. You can find just an amazing amount of resources from them. Also visit their website and the Bisexual Health Awareness Month 2015 WordPress site.
Yeah, I've been reading some really great articles that folks have written for Bi Health Month.
Some really
interesting.
Yeah, and the Los Angeles Bi Task Force actually just released their Bisexual Needs Assessment PDF file today. So that is really worth checking into.
Now, can you tell us what's in there? Have you had a chance to review it well enough to?
I just opened it up, and it talks. I haven't been able to review the whole thing, but it talks a lot about how we feel accepted in the larger communities, how we would like to be accepted in large communities, some of the issues that we face. And I believe, and I'm not sure, I haven't gotten far enough to find out on how we can actually solve some of these issues. Mm-hmm. But there are some reports that the bisexuality report put out by the UK group actually talk about how people think groups, workplaces, schools, LGBT centers, can actually do to promote bi and trans, inclusivity, and which is part of our biggest problem, is because we do feel isolated and ostracized from the communities, and feel quite alone. And it has some great resources for that.
Wonderful. Let me pose this to you, Lynette, first, and then Morgan after. What would you like to see happen here in the Portland area to help bisexual folks feel more secure, more safe?
I would like to see our local center spend a little more time focusing on some of our issues, promoting some of our resources in form of pamphlets, links on their website. It would have been nice to have seen them actually promote the Bi Health Month on the center site and help support some of these programs that we would like to get started in the community center as it is. Cameron Crude runs a great Bi-Can discussion group through there. I would like to see more things happen. I think that there needs to be programs for the youth, coming out youth, so they feel more supported, for the older community members. And I think that there just needs to be some training and dialogue by everyone on the staff and people that come in about what bisexuality really is and how you should interact with bisexual people. Mm-hmm. It would be a big, giant help. One of the biggest problems we have is that it is not politically correct to talk poorly about gay and lesbian people, whether people really, accept you or not. That's another thing. But we simply don't have the language to know how to talk to bisexual people, and we deal with a lot of misconceptions, stereotypes, biphobia, and it's very damaging to people's psyche.
Thanks, Lynette. What about you, Morgan? What would you like to see happen here in the area that our communities can do to support folks who are bisexual?
I think the number one thing I'd like to see is more visible bisexual community. I agree with Lynette. Cameron has done a wonderful job with his discussion group and, making sure that there is some public presence of the bisexual community. But I would love to see more. I know that based on the number of people that I've run into, talked to, work with, there are a lot of bisexual people here in Portland, and yet they're not easy to find, despite the magic of the internet and, things like PQ Monthly and the Q Center. And so I would just like to see, I would like to see more of a sense of bisexual community.
Okay. And here's hoping that our local queer community center hangs in there long enough to make some of these things happen, going through a stressful time.
Yeah.
And folks are working hard to keep the doors open and programming running. So we look forward to seeing what happens with that. Let's talk about this notion of invisibility in the general community for bisexuals and in the queer community, you know, where things like, well, a big one obviously is that gay marriage has sort of taken such a leading role in our energies, that a lot of things have sort of been pushed off to the side and said, wait your turn if you get one. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I think there are a lot of folks who can point to particular aspects of, let's say, queer life that are not getting the attention they need. And partly that's a matter of priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So where can we go from here on that? How can we develop a new language? Because I think that... I think folks do find bisexuality hard to pin down,
mm-hmm.
hard to describe if it's not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go from there?
I think that's okay. I think it's okay if it's not easy to pin down. I think trying to pin it down sometimes is what leads to either biphobia or bisexual invisibility or erasure, where... you know, we're trying to cram bisexuality into one end or the other of the monosexism boxes. So I think a growing ability to sit with the awkwardness that maybe that causes, not quite being able to relate to that. Mm-hmm. I do think that's okay. In terms of what I'd like to see, where I think we could go with being more inclusive, would be things like if this is an LGBT whatever, there should be bisexual specific things included in there. Oftentimes, you know, I refer to it as big L, big G, little B, little T, because it seems like bisexuality kind of gets swooped into whatever the lesbian and gay specific either programming or research is, which then ends up making the bisexual individuals kind of invisible in that context.
Or even just sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the queer population, bisexuals are no small part of it.
No, it's half.
Half.
Yeah.
Depending on what survey you look at, we can be anywhere from 40 to almost half of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So it is something that we need to address. And I agree with Morgan, is that you don't have to actually understand what it means. I think what we need to start with is just be accepting when someone tells you. And let them explain it to you. Come from a non-judgmental place. And I think that will open a lot of doors and help people educate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And just see, just whatever you thought that bisexuality was, just take all of that and remove that from your brain and actually speak with, you know, spend time on the bisexual organization site. Spend time with bisexual people, and get to know them. We're not aliens. I think that will be a lot of progress could be made that way.
Sure. Now, going back to what we talked about a bit ago, with these really alarming statistics about the health aspects of bisexuals. In our community and in our nation, that seems like we could almost, we could fairly identify that, we could label that a crisis,
mm.
a crisis of care, a crisis of self-care, a crisis of community care.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be great if we could start to tell that story as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that those particular kinds of pain are brought out into the open.
Mm-hmm.
More so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think it's part of by invisibility, just to not know that, just to not know that there are people in our community who suffer worse than, you know, than your stereotypical, I guess. That's not a word I mean, but your median queer person.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine that youth who are bisexual suffer a great deal, struggle.
You know, I don't know what the statistics are on youth specifically. Do you, Lynette?
I'm trying to find them. I know that they're pretty high on the suicidality rate, but I'm trying to find the exact amount.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, part of that is that there's no one, media does not cover bisexuality in a too honest way. With the information they get is very, it's not good if they get any, and they don't really have representation. It is not rejoiced when someone comes out as bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually questioned. And, you know, case in point, Lady Gaga has said over and over again, "Oh, I'm bisexual," and it's always questioned. And if someone comes out as gay, it's very heroic. So there has to be a way that media and people actually change the language they use with, you know, with our youth especially. They need to have something to look to. And you know, I hear a lot of our young people say they go to the LGBTQ centers and they, you know, go in there and I think I'm bisexual, and because people don't really know anything about it, many times they can worry the feeling that they have been told, well, you know, really gay, there's no such thing as bisexuality, and you know, it just adds to this whole feeling of low self-esteem and non-acceptance. It is, you know, it's pretty horrendous. You know, it's hard for people to deal with that.
There's certainly always a hope that youth will teach us what we need to know, but they need a hand.
Mm-hmm.
First, before they can do that, they need to have some pretty basic needs met before they're going to show us the way into the future. So I want to remind folks that, as Lynette said, you can hashtag BiHealthMonth. I actually don't really know it. I mean, I see it all the time on the web, what hashtag is, but I don't actually know what it means. But other folks will, and I think if you just type hashtag BiHealthMonth into your browser, it should lead you where you're supposed to go.
It will. It'll take you there.
Lynette, and do you want to give us the websites where folks can find more information?
There is the BinetUSA.org site. You can also join the BinetUSA Facebook group. The people that are doing the actual BiHealthMonth is a bisexualresourcecenter.org. They also have the Bisexual Health Awareness Month 2015.wordpress.com page. There's information at the American Institute for Bisexuality. And there are several UK sites that are absolutely fabulous. We also have our Bisexual Organizing Project site, which runs a community gathering every year for the non-monosexual community, which is completely awesome, and they have information. And, of course, there is my podcast, The Bicast,
mm-hmm.
and that is simply thebicast.org. All kinds of information everywhere on there. I have links available for all the different topics on there.
Wonderful. So we'll provide links as well to some of those sites, as well as to the local bisexual gatherings and groups here in town. We're running out of time, so we're just going to close up there. You can find us on Facebook and look for those links coming up in the next few days on KBOO Out Loud on Facebook. Lynette, thanks so much for joining us, and Morgan as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for the work you're doing for the bisexual community and folks in it, and for the experience in that you brought to us our discussion today.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, Hard Knock Radio is up next. Thanks so much, listeners.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and online at www.kbu.fm. The time is 7 o'clock. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers,